I am a preacher, and I wish I could preach this evening on Psalm 87, but I will give you a little bit of a, I hope, provocative note and urge you to think about it more. It's one of my favorite psalms, and it's one of the greatest missionary songs. But I'll do that very briefly, and I'd like to speak to you about God's place for Islam in history. And then we move on to see what God is doing today among Muslims. All of that is not something you hear even in the evangelical media, let alone in the secular media. But before that, I'd like to bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters as far away as Indonesia. When I was a little boy, my father, who grew up Presbyterian, and he was not really converted until later in his life, he would tell us that Christians in Indonesia were only about 2.5% of the population. That includes Catholics and everywhere. Well, officially, now they are a little over 19%, but in reality, they are close to 30%. And it's always heartwarming to meet with Reform people in Indonesia. It's a wonderful place, and we thank God that even though it's still called MERV, we, Middle East, Indonesia is one of our growing fields. And I will give you a little more about that later. And I bring you greetings also from your brothers and sisters in Pakistan. The church there is not growing fast, but they are growing. And in the providence of God, despite the difficulties that are very slowly, numbers of people joining the churches there from Muslim background. But the church in Iran is one of the most encouraging, growing Christian communities. And we thank God for the fact that we have brothers and sisters inside Iran worshiping. What time is it now? Yeah, they're not worshiping now. Maybe some of them are praying. And I bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Palestine. There are single congregations in each of Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates. In fact, in the United Arab Emirates, there are 5 or 6 congregations that are quite reformed. There are many other congregations, but these are mostly English-speaking congregations with Arabic, one Arabic congregation. And there is one congregation in the Sultanate of Oman. You cross over the Red Sea. One of the largest Reform communities is in North and South Sudan. And the Presbyterian community in Egypt is quite large. It's several hundred thousand large. I bring you greetings also from brothers and sisters worshiping in places like Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and our own congregation in Larnaca in Cyprus. Psalm 87 speaks of the church. And one of the exciting things for me is the mention of two nations in my background. I don't understand why they translate Egypt here as Rahab. By the way, it's not Rahab, it is Rahab. And Pastor Ahmed will tell you, because Arabic and Hebrew are related Semitic languages, Rahab is the root for the word terror in Arabic and in Hebrew. And the reason this was one of the names in the Old Testament for Egypt is because they remember the terror. Now, if you are Jewish, and you don't believe in Christ, I don't know how you would make heads or tails of this. See, here you have the Lord speaking of Zion, and born into Zion, the great nations of the past that enslaved them, then the great nation contemporary that was about to take them into captivity. And then notice what else it says. As far away as Cush. That was the end of the world in those days. So you have the great nations of the past, the future. Then you have the poor people of Philistia and the rich people. The representative. And this is not something that should have surprised them if they were thinking of God's ways, because already that was God's promise to Abraham. When he established the Hebrew nation, God said to Abraham, there is a purpose. Please read, you see, I wish evangelicals would understand that. In Genesis 12, 1 to 3, the purpose of it all, at the end of verse 3, and I will bless all families of the earth. Later on, Abraham, well, his name was Abram, father of one nation. His name is changed to Abraham, the father of many nations. And then he was told in chapter 15 that that's not going to happen in his days. And gradually he's telling him about the seed. And who is that seed? That's the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. And that's why he could not come through the line of Adam. He's the new Adam. And he is the one here described as the most beautiful part related to Zion. He's the gate. Isn't that what Jesus says? I am the door. And the purpose of it all, notice, is the praise of God among all nations. And notice also this wonderful thing that Jesus expected Nicodemus to understand. This one and that one was born in her. The rich, the poor, the far and the near, the great, the not so great, from every tongue, from every tribe, from every kindred, and from every nation. And praise God that even this evening we can celebrate that God has fulfilled his promises. I grew up in a Christian family, and I mentioned to you about my father. My mother was converted from the Coptic Church. And it was my mother who was zealously leading us to the Lord. My father was educated. She was not educated. But she knew the Bible. And she was zealous to teach us the Bible and pray with us. We had Muslim friends, and father had Muslim people working with him. And my mother had a Muslim lady or two helping her with housework and so on. And I remember my mother praying with us before we went to school, before we went to bed. She prays for family members, for relatives, for people in the church, all Christians. She never prayed for Muslims. All you're thinking about is your survivor. And they were, somehow we didn't say it. That's how I grew up. Even God could not convert such beasts. But I'm afraid this is the spirit of what we see today. It's true, there is such a thing as Islamophobia. And Christians should not be like that. And I was like that. And many people were like that. Until I learned the Old Testament lesson, then I realized why God allowed Islam to to go after the church. The church, by the turn of the 6th century, was a church without the Bible and without the true Christ of Scriptures. They were actually, the church was persecuting the minority of true Christians. And they were competing with each other as who is the true, who is the true bishop taking the authority of St. Peter and the keys. Was it the bishop of Rome, the Pope, or the Pope of Alexandria, or the Archbishop of Antioch, Jerusalem, Constantinople? In Arabia, about one-third of people in Western Arabia, where Muhammad grew up, were Christians, but they didn't have the Bible. And you know, to them, Christ was an example of suffering, because monasticism was taking place in those days. Muhammad never heard the gospel. And the church worldwide was in a bad shape. Now, when you study carefully as a Christian, and we all should study history carefully as a Christian, you'd realize that God's hand was on Muhammad. And if it weren't for Islam, I don't want to mean to shock anybody, but if it weren't for Islam, you and I would not be here. You know why? Because Islam was used by God to advance against the church. They took over the Middle East, they took over North Africa, major parts of Southern Europe. From North Africa, they took over Spain, Portugal, major parts of France. And there was a time when they were surrounding the heart of Europe in Vienna. And the church was concerned about the Holy Land. I don't want to get into this, but there's nothing holy about it. I wouldn't want to live there. So it was only they can't do it for the coming of the one who would bless all families of the earth. Well, the Crusades failed, and Islam was going more and more. And all of a sudden, Islam begins to crumble from within and retreat. What was happening in Europe? You know the answer. There is a reason I said, if it weren't for Islam, you and I would not be here. Because Islam actually exhausted the energies of the most powerful church at the time that's dominating. In fact, they were threatening earlier, they were threatening the Egyptian church, which invited the Muslim armies to go through northern Egypt, because they were in Carthage, that's the place of Augustine, today Tunisia, and they were preparing to advance eastward to subject the Bishop of Alexandria to be under the Pope. And of course, the Egyptian church invited the Muslims to stop that. Well, the church with its military and economic power was shrinking in its influence. They went after the Reformation in France, but they were exhausted. They could not. The Muslims were surrounding them from the south, from the east, and they were beginning to surround them from the southwest. And they could not go. The church could not go after the Reformation in the north and the northwest. And as Islam crumbles, the Lord in His providence was preparing the church to go back to the Bible more and more. And when the church went back to the Bible, what happens? That's the Reformation. And as the church went back to the Bible more and more, and they said, oh, the gospel is not just for us. They remembered the Great Commission. Ahmed and I come from Arabic-speaking background. You know who gave us the Arabic Bible? There was a Dutchman by the name of Cornelius van Dyck, and a Scotsman by the name of Eli Smith. And they worked together, the Dutch and the Scots. And these were brilliant people. They were not the leftover ministers who were running away to the mission field. I met some missionaries like that. But these were brilliant people. They learned one of the most difficult languages, worked with Arabic language scholars. And after 11 years, they spent another 11 years with these Arabic language scholars, some of them converted. And they put together the Arabic Bible. It's still called the Smith van Dyck version. And when you have the Bible, what happens? First, it touched the nominal Christians. And so there began to be a solid Reformed presence. And by the way, I say Reformed because all the pioneer missionaries that went to the Muslim world as Islam crumbled and the colonial power started to compete over the Muslim world and other parts of the world. You know, you had the Brits and the French and the Belgians and the Italians and the Spaniards and the Dutch and the Germans and whoever else. And they went and they occupied the Muslim world and other parts of the world. And they were not interested in the gospel. They were interested in minerals and spices and tea and naval vessels and political control and so on. But with them came the freedom. And all pioneer missionaries that went from Morocco to Indonesia were faithful Reformed people. In fact, most of the main languages in the Muslim world received their Bibles through pioneer Reformed missionaries. And this is not, by the way, a coincidence. Islam is a solid world and life view. And you cannot approach it with a simplistic message. Like Islam has a very high view of Allah. Of course, it's not the true way. Even though we use the same name, Christians use the same name, Allah, for God before Islam. People do not realize Allah and Elohim have the same root. It's a Semitic root. But as they came, they gave us the Bible, then churches were established. And it took us so many years to come to the point where we are today. Today, brothers and sisters, we are living in special days. I never dreamed, and that, by the way, this is not because of Murph. We are only a little part in God's ways of bringing the gospel. We just happen to be there at the right time with the right message. And we thank God that we see the wonderful foundation of faithful pioneer missionaries. By the way, those pioneer missionaries, they knew what they were doing. And they always worked themselves out of a job in order to allow the local people to take charge and grow and so on. Ayatollah Khomeini, what do you think of him? Most of you are too young to remember that. Well, Ayatollah Khomeini came to power in the late 70s, and he claimed the world for Islam, and there was a big euphoria. Pastor Ahmed, I remember, you're too young for that. استقبال. Lisa and I were back in Beirut serving as OPC missionaries, and I remember all the stickers around and the billboards, Islam would help, Islam is the solution. And there was a euphoria throughout the Middle East. Now we have a leader, now we are going to take on the world. Not long after that, the war between Iraq and Iran started. And the media doesn't tell you what kind of war it was between, you know, that's the beginning of what will actually end up destroying, physically destroying. And you see, it's going on now in Iraq, in Syria, in Iran, in Pakistan. Saddam Hussein was representing the Sunnis, and Ayatollah Khomeini was representing the Shiites. 8 years of war, 1.5 million people died. About 3 million were maimed. And the Sunnis were asking, on whose side was Allah? And the Shiites were asking, on whose side was Allah? And as I mentioned last night, I remember reading this about people coming to Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. Is God on our side or on the Confederate side? And the answer of Abraham Lincoln was, the question is, who is on the side of God, not on whose side is God? Brothers and sisters, it is the beginning, it was the beginning of the modern Muslim disenchantment with Islam. You know, 53% of Iranians are totally disenchanted with Islam. The government knows that. And by the way, the government doesn't talk religion anymore. The government now in Iran talks nationalism. Well, that happens in America too, you see. When you want to get people excited after the politicians, then they pump up nationalism. And anyway, all politicians use it. Well, Khomeini is gone. Thousands of people were killed. Tens of thousands of people were killed. And that included about 440 evangelical Christians, mostly of Muslim background. 33 pastors, two of them were friends of mine. In fact, one of them went to seminary with me. And the pastors that were executed, they were martyred. They were martyred for one reason, because already under Khomeini, more and more Iranians were becoming Christians. And these pastors, they would have evidence against them that they were holding secret meetings and baptizing Muslim converts. Well, the church, you know, the Iranian church, the Farsi-speaking church, is growing today by leaps and bounds. You know, we have a media Farsi ministry on radio and on the internet, and it's exciting to see what is going on. Algeria, 40% of Algerians already publicly, without fear, saying we are not Muslims. 20 years ago, in fact 18 years ago, there was not one single congregation in Algiers, the capital. Today there are 28 congregations that we know of. Brothers and sisters, there are three enemies of Islam that people do not realize are playing havoc with Islam. First enemy is knowledge. You see, knowledge means thinking. And knowledge began with education over the last 180 years. Gradually, more and more education is taking place. And people begin to read, to think, but they are afraid. People are beginning to wonder, but they are not allowed to wonder too much. But then came radio and television and satellite, and now the internet. And the genie is out of the bottle. They can no longer tell the people, the imams will think for you. The clergy will think for you. Today, we are seeing information that was banned on the internet. Information that raises more and more doubt on the minds of Muslims. That's why you see, especially in urban areas, the more people are exposed to the internet, the more they're exposed to information. And then doubts. You know, there are now people who publicly say they are atheists or agnostic. 10 years ago, they would have been killed. And that brings me to the second point, freedom. Anybody that tells you, by the way, that an Islamic-based government is going to be established and last in any of these countries, they are confused. You see, Morsi came to power and he wanted to impose Islam. And what happens? 33 million people went to the streets. And the army had to depose him. In Tunisia, the Islamists were well organized. They won the election, and then the population turned against them, and they were smarter in Tunisia. They had to make a compromise before they were removed from power to power share. And all their plans to introduce Islamic legislation and so on evaporated. People publicly say, we do not want this. You have women in Tahrir Square in Cairo, Egypt, standing up and saying, I don't allow my husband to have a second wife. That's against Islamic Sharia. Or she'd say, oh, I want to have the right to divorce my husband too. Because Islamic Sharia is one way, you see. A woman, and you have young men and young women publicly saying that a woman is not half a man. According to Islamic legislation, if I had a daughter and a son, and I die, and there is inheritance for them, she inherits half what the son inherits. And then all kinds of things, you know, about the whipping, about the cutting of the hands, about the freedom to embrace another faith and so on, all of that is collapsing. A couple of weeks ago, we had that story about the woman in Sudan. And of course, it becomes a tale even among evangelicals. And actually, I was laughing when they said, oh, they're going to execute her. I said, not today. Not today. It didn't take 2 weeks, and the government found a way to reverse itself. Because the world has become a global village. They cannot hide anything anymore. And then you have the young people saying, I want to think for myself. They can no longer impose ideas on young people. So freedom. Freedom of choice. Freedom of belief and so on is growing. throughout the Muslim world today. And the third one is something you don't like, but we love. Secularism. Pluralism, secularism. You know what secularism for us means? Not one religion is imposed. Secularism means there is freedom of religion. And freedom of religion is one of the major enemies of Islam. Secularism means you cannot impose Islamic education and so on. And that is growing everywhere. And then the fact is that only 4.7% of Muslims today worldwide know enough Islam and have enough commitment to Islam. The media doesn't tell you that. Even the evangelical media doesn't tell you that. In a country like Indonesia, you see, oh, there are maybe 140 million people who call themselves Muslims. Less than 1% of them know enough to know what Islam actually teaches. Even in Pakistan, you know, you hear about the Taliban. Even in the areas controlled by Taliban, even some of those militants following Taliban, they know very little of Islam. Only in two places the percentage is reasonably high. And that's, it's growing down, it's going down too. Among the Egyptians and among the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. It's a little over 30% according to the research. In Saudi Arabia, can you think of that? In Saudi Arabia, only 13.8% of Saudis are practicing Islam. This is a country where at the prayer time, especially on Friday, the Mutawa is the one who enforces Islam, and they have special belts. They go around, if you are on the street, or in a restaurant, anywhere that's public, and you're not in the mosque at the time of prayer, midday Friday, they have the right to take you out and whip you in public. If you are a woman walking on the street and your leg is showing, even the end of your leg is showing, they use those whips to punish you. Even in Saudi Arabia, not even 14% of the Saudis are practicing Islam. So, what about Muslims in America, in the Netherlands, in the UK, in Germany? Is God in control? Yes. You believe that God is in control?
Amen.
Why is God allowing them here? Why is God allowing them here? We must take seriously, you know, Romans 8:28, what does it say? Romans 8:28, what does it say?
All things work together.
Say it again. Say it again.
All things work together for good.
Not quite. You see, it begins with a very important word. And. Or for. Because the context there is cosmic. It's talking about the whole thing. Past, present, and future. All creation. All the system. Were great things and not so great things. Things we like and things we don't like. It's actually talking about sufferings. All things work out together. For what? See, Islam is part of all things. Some of you older would remember the big euphoria about communism. Oh, in those days too, you know, we had those television televangelists. When they were running out of money or they wanted more money, they worked on the scare tactic of communism. And if you remember the late, great planet Earth. Remember that, Pastor? And Armageddon, the battle between communism and Christianity over Jerusalem. Well, communism collapsed. Had evangelicals asked the question, why did God allow communism after 70 years of collapse? See, communism broke the backbone of the most anti-Christ church in history, the Russian Orthodox Church. You go study for yourself. You see the tactics they use to control people. Witchcraft even. Magic, witchcraft. And communism comes with its atheism, and the church loses its control of people, and now there are millions of evangelical believers in the former Soviet Union. Who is in control? And the church in America better wake up, you know? The church in America better wake up. Maybe God is going to use this land. Maybe God is using, God's going to use something like it. If the church apostatizes, you see, God uses forces to bring it back. And the problem, brothers and sisters, the problem is that we forget that in the Bible there is a teaching that's exact opposite of the popular teaching in America today of the success gospel. It's about suffering. Paul tells the Philippians it's a gift from God. It's a gift from God, like faith. It's given to you not only to believe, but to suffer. That's the end of chapter 1. In chapter 3, he talks about, even in the context of talking about the power of the resurrection, the fellowship of his suffering. And Jesus himself said, the more you're going to follow me, the more you're going to suffer. In the world you will have tribulations, and the apostles in Acts, through many trials and tribulations, that we must enter the kingdom of God. And you think that unless Christianity, by the way, it's not one of the words I like. Christian, what is Christianity? What's Christianity? In Arabic, we refuse to use that word. In our ministry, we refuse to use that word. Because it has cultural and political connotations. You have Christianity and Islam. So what's Christianity? Romanism? Liberalism? Easy believism? What's Christianity? It's a Christian faith. It's a teaching that leads people to Christ. And Christianity without Christ is another false religion. It's another works religion. Brothers and sisters, we are living in special days in which Christ is shining to Muslims. You know, we have a website. By the way, it's not about me. You know, when Lisa and I moved to Cyprus, we only had 15 minutes a week of radio work on medium wave. And then it became 3 slots a week. And then the Lord prospered, and as it grew, we had so many people trained to help. Nowadays, it used to frighten me, Ahmed. A few years ago, maybe 7-8 years ago, I used to think, well, if I travel, I teach in different places, and you take flights, you hear about, you know, airplane crashes. So I worried about my family, and I was concerned about the Arabic broadcast. Well, if something happens to me, I know that the Arabic broadcast and the media ministry will go on without me. I wish I had a short video to show you the wonderful teams. And we're living special days. Even our center, ministry center, is in downtown Cairo. We used to be secretive about publishing a book in Egypt. And the government, they actually registered. They are registered as employees in what something like Social Security. Publicly. We have a wonderful team in Lebanon. And the government in North Sudan, the government in North Sudan gives us 1 hour on national radio every week and 1 hour on national TV. And we don't have to pay for the airtime. We have to pay for the staff and the production. And that goes every week. 1 hour. It's the only place where the only time you get involved in television, because you just have free television. Television is very expensive. And faith comes, by the way, faith comes by hearing, and hearing the word of God. Before I allow some time for questions, we have time still. We started a bit late. Murph is involved in a fourfold ministry. We call it a holistic ministry of evangelism, using our specialty, by the way, is in evangelism, is using the media, radio, and the internet in reaching Muslims. So evangelism by radio, but we also work with local churches training evangelists under their oversight. South Sudan is one of our biggest fields, a growing field in Indonesia. We have that also taking place in other countries. So that leads to church extension. Murph is not a church. We do not do church extension, but we work with local churches providing literature and training and sometimes funding. One of the recent projects is with probably one of the largest presbyteries in the world of any kind, the presbytery in Minya in the heart of Egypt. Now, Murph is partnering with them, and they have 17 church planting projects. We committed for 5 years already, 2 years passed, 3 more years to go, and there have been 3 congregations organized. And that's all done by the local churches under the oversight of a presbytery. Then we have the backbone of Murph's work, is biblical training. Without biblical training, we cannot have proper media ministry, we cannot have proper evangelism, proper church extension, proper literature work. And then we have the fourth area is called diaconal aid. We don't call it relief, because if you get involved in relief, gradually you drift away. If you go to Merck's website and you go to the manual, you'll see there are principles for doing diaconal aid. And diaconal aid must always go in conjunction with the ministry of the word and always under the oversight of local churches. And we thank God that when we did that in Iran, it was very productive. When we did that in Pakistan, it was very productive. We're doing that in Syria today, very productive. In Sudan, in Lebanon, in Egypt, especially among Sudanese refugees. In Indonesia, we mostly do micro projects, especially among Muslim converts. And the micro projects means they pay back. And then when they pay back, more funds are added to it and more people have micro projects, but it's always in conjunction with the ministry of the church. In Indonesia today, we have training center and 5 broadcast and media ministry languages. Toraja, the Torajanese people became nominal reform people, but they're very open to teaching. The Torajanese people are about 1.5 million people in the mountains in the central part of South Sulawesi. Sulawesi is that funny island about 2 hours flight from Java. 90% of the Torajanese people and another neighboring tribe called Mumasa, they are nominal reformed. They go to church on Sunday and so on, but there is very little gospel. They are not liberal. They are not liberal by choice. They are just not taught. You go to, I preach in some of those churches, and you're surprised. It's like you read about the Dutch churches. You know, you have the scribe sitting, taking notes, who is going and who is coming, and then the offerings and a certain ritual you go through. But they're open for teaching. Now we're actually using the Toraja broadcast, not for evangelism, but for teaching. So Toraja language, the Bugis language, the Bugis are among the most fanatical Muslims in the eastern part of Indonesia. I said western, it's eastern part of Java, east of Java. And then Makassarese. On the main island of Java, we thank God, a few years ago, we started broadcasting an internet ministry in the largest language, the Javanese language, and now also in the Sundanese language. There are many more churches among the Javanese and very few churches among the Sunda people. But they're very nominal. They're nominal Muslims. They might be fanatical. You might be fanatical, but they don't really know Islam. And you have the right people, and you train them, and then they go with the gospel. One of our projects now for Indonesia is building a center for training Sunda evangelists. Now, we don't, by the way, teach in Greek and Hebrew and sophisticated stuff. If you do that, like for South Sudan, and these people are ministering to their own people in mud huts, and they come to them with exegetical notes and all the finer points of theology, they cannot do that. In the future, as they expand, more and more academic they could become. But right now, they need the gospel. And so, please pray for this project in Java. That's our next training project. We have training projects also in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Cyprus, training centers. And the most active training center is in Lokichogyo. Lokichogyo is on the border between Kenya, in northern Kenya, and South Sudan. It was opened in 2003. And we thank God, because the church in South Sudan, I'm talking about Presbyterian churches in South Sudan, the Presbyterian churches in South Sudan are about 2 million strong. And some of the people we had trained, I think we've had at least about 800 so far go through training, 700-800 go through training since 2003. They come for a few months. We fly them, they're using charter flights, a missionary organization called AIM Air. We partner with them, and we fly them for a few months, then the planes go back and bring the next group. Some of those people we trained were ordained pastors, and they didn't know the books of the Bible. This is how much biblical training is very, very central for missionary work today. We get short-term teachers, pastors from the UK, from the Netherlands, some from America, some from Canada, some from Australia, They go there for a few weeks. They teach. Somebody is coordinating the program of their teaching for each group. And these people go back mostly to South Sudan, some to Tanzania or Kenya or Uganda. And that's what's happening in Sulawesi. We work together with the churches in Lahore, Pakistan. These churches were kind of nominal Presbyterian. Now, we thank God they're open for deeper teaching, they're open for training to work among Muslims. And some of the most exciting times we have had was training Iranian converts. It is amazing how this is very productive. One of the men we trained now is leading the Farsi-speaking ministry. And now we have a couple converted in our church in Larnaca. They are refugee seekers, trained also. They are helping with the radio and internet ministry. I will stop here, Pastor, if there is time for some questions.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
I'll pass this here if you'd like to. By the way, in our newsletters, we never ask for money. And now it's internet, it doesn't cost any more.
What kind of materials do you use for training?
Well, it depends what kind of materials used for training. It depends on the group. Sometimes, like in Lokachogyu, it's a simple, they follow summary of Christian doctrine, and they add to it an introduction to the Old Testament and the New Testament, and a bit of church history. But mostly in Lokachogyu, they follow summary of Christian doctrine.
Yeah. Summary of Christian doctrine.
Not literally, but that kind of...
Right. It's that kind of an outline.
Yeah. In Indonesia, we thank God, in a training center in Makassar, they're following a little higher program.
Okay.
And the Lord has really blessed in Makassar, one of the largest seminaries in Indonesia. Originally, it was established by a Canadian missionary. It was a lot smaller. It was Jaffrey, called Jaffrey University. Jaffrey Bible College, now it's called Seminary. They have 450 students today. And we thank God. The professors gradually have become more and more reformed, and now reformed teaching, and by the way, when I say reformed, it's not just doctrinaire, because our main thrust is evangelism. It's not just, we don't even talk about Calvinism and so on. When you use those terms, you lose people. Everything we do is from the reformed point of view, evangelism and church extension and so on. It is from the reformed perspective. But the new president of the seminary is actually going to be an advisor to the board of Merck. He's a solid reformed man, Dr. Daniel Runda. I never dreamed to see such a thing happening. And it was, that influence came gradually through the team leader in Sulawesi. This man comes from a Muslim background. His name is Pastor Armin Sukri. If you go back in one of the newsletters, he authored one of the newsletters on the website. You can download it. And this man, when we first met him, he was not reformed. He was zealous and so on, but you could see now he's still zealous for evangelism. He's still interested in training people to disciple Muslims from reformed perspectives and so on. But then he had this vision, and gradually the Lord blessed his influence on the seminary in Makassar.
Any other questions? Anyone else?
One more question?
I have a question about I'm going to call it a good Muslim, how what he believes and what he practices, and the comparison between that and these young people that have come from Muslim backgrounds and that have maybe departed from that kind of practice, what they really believe and how they practice.
You don't realize, brother, that Islam is very diverse. I have a three-volume book. It's actually 10. It's called the Milad wa Nahal in Islam, the sex and the branches of Islam. It's from the Middle Ages. And it claims to be a fulfillment of the prophet's prediction that his people would be divided into 700 groups. And this guy takes the Sunni branch, which is the largest, and the Shiite branch, and each of them has more than 300 branches. They divide over all kinds of things. This includes Sharia law and the rest of it. What do they practice? Well, if they are serious Muslims, they will be praying 5 times a day, including getting up at dawn to pray. And of course, they would follow the other restrictions. Depends on the branch of Islam they're following. We have an Arabic ministry website, Facebook page. By the way, I don't have Facebook, please of us. And I don't want to have a Facebook page. But a young lady from our staff, well, not so young, she's a young mother. She's an amazing lady. She has 2 children and she does more work than I do. She had a vision of establishing a Facebook page. And it's called Aqwalu Isa al-Masih, the sayings of Christ. Every day, when I don't have Facebook, but I couldn't stop it. I was excited about it. And she was right. Every day, it's become a very popular Facebook page. Every day there is a new saying of Christ. Aqwalu Isa al-Masih, the sayings of Christ. And you would be amazed at the response, especially of young Muslims. Well, when they are told you go on a suicide bombing, and then they read Jesus saying, love your enemies, isn't that enough? You see the difference? It's actually, Imad, when I studied missiology, they would always tell you, and even today, some evangelical seminaries, they tell you to tone down the teaching of Christ and so on. It's the exact opposite. The exact opposite. It's the person of Christ, the work of Christ. The Bible is clear, no one can come to God except through Christ. Nobody knows God. No one has ever seen God. The only one who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. And who is that? Jesus Christ. The issue is that we use language and words that they understand.
There are thousands of Muslims that go to that page, and many that are friends immediately receive those verses. And they love it.
And they comment on it. They comment.
They like them. They like them.
We do not, some of the comments occasionally have a nasty comment because they could see so many Muslims positive. And they send you a threatening message. Then you should see the response of other Muslims. Shut up. We love this. Yes, Pastor.
Maybe I could ask a question for myself and for Pastor Bond. What can churches, small churches like ours, how can we be of service after that?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question. You see, the question is, what can small churches like ours
small churches are the best, actually, for praying.
I agree.
And for vision. You know, prayer is the most important thing. I have been told by pastors like yourself is that one of the reasons they thank God for the work of birth is that it brings them a sense of assurance and comfort about the power of the gospel and the impact of the gospel among Muslim people. Missions, brothers and sisters, is not about maybe. It's not about maybe. Missions is about the power of the gospel. And the power of the gospel is always bearing fruit. And we thank God nowadays we have people in Iran. I have never been to Iran. And most likely I will not go, even though I can go now with a secret passport. But I don't need to go. We have workers in Iran. I know about the standards, the costs of having a missionary. We have workers in Iran. They cost maybe $300-$400 a month. And some of them have several discipling groups. Quietly. But they know, they don't need to learn the language. They do not need to adjust the culture. And they do not need a visa. And they do not need to be paranoid. They know how to work with their own people. And it's amazing what the Lord is doing through people like that in Iran, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, even in North Sudan, in places like Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, in places like Egypt. And I would like to encourage you by telling you, this is where I grew up in the early years in Egypt. That have the number of converts in Egypt today is far greater than the number of converts for 1400 years. It's amazing what is going on. Of course, you have a great deal of disenchantment with Islam. Disenchantment with Islam is growing. And do not be frightened. Sooner or later, in their interactions, in the information they receive, we noticed in the Chicago area, the second and the third and the fourth generation of Muslims, they want to become Americans. They celebrate Christmas and so on. Sooner or later, they are going to be disenchanted with Islam. Now, why do they look so tight and fanatical? I say this, you know, I know a lot about Dutch people. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I noticed that Dutch immigrants in places like Canada, America, Australia, they are more Dutch than the Dutch. They are outside, they want to cling to their background. That applies to Irish, it applies to other people. So, when Muslims come to America, they're like that. I noticed that about Coptic people. You know, they come to America and all their associations are in the Coptic church. Then the next generation, they lose the Arabic and then they lose the church because the church is identified with Arabic. That's why when people immigrate, I don't go, by the way, to Arabic-speaking churches. I tell you that those that have influence on those churches encourage the people to go to sound American churches because you're going to lose the young people. Because after they forget the Arabic, they leave the church. Well, thank you for your prayers. And that's all I can ask you for, to pray. And the last thing I'm going to say is that I would ask you to specifically remember a few things. I'm going to be 65 next month, Lord willing, if the Lord spares me. One of my main concerns is the next generation of leaders. Organizations can drift. So I would like to ask you, thank God, we have wonderful people in the next generation. But do pray that the Lord will preserve the organization faithful to the historic
Christian faith and to the scriptures. And the second thing that I would like to ask you to pray is pray for God's people in Syria. Thank God that even though initially they were supported by Western powers, the Islamists are losing in Syria. But remember especially the Christians in the north and the northwestern part of Syria. They're still, the government has not taken hold of that area yet. Please pray for the pastors and others who are involved in providing the ethnic aid along with the word of God in Syria. Pray for God's people in Iraq. It has not been easy for them. And continue to be encouraged about the Lord's people in Iran and pray for them. Pray also that the new president in Egypt will continue to be sympathetic to Christians, and that the Lord will protect people who are sympathetic to minority Christians and minorities and others. Pray for the radio work and growing internet ministry. I never thought internet would be such a thing used of the Lord. You know, we used to worry about smuggling Bibles to Saudi Arabia. We don't have to do that anymore. It's on the internet. And the government cannot stop it. And the clergymen cannot control the lives of their people through their relatives. If they have a Bible, they used to hide it under the pillow or under the mattress and so on. Well, they don't need to do that anymore. Thank you very much for your prayers.